Good morning, everyone. We'd like to welcome you to the Mesa City Council study session for the morning of November the 7th. Mr. Freeman is attending a water conference right now, so we appreciate him doing that, and he's excused. Everyone else is present. The first item on our agenda today is to hear a presentation and provide direction on proposed quality development design guidelines to guide development in the city and related text amendments to our code. Welcome. We've got our great planning department here.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. So for the past year, Council has directed staff to look into revising our quality design standards in the city to kind of guide development proposals. In addition, when the general plan was approved in 2014, one of the implementation tools was for the city or staff to pursue ways of improving our design standards. So basically, for the past year, we've been working with a consultant and staff as well to review various standards across the metro area and also look at industrial standards to come up with design standards that we think is going to improve our quality of design and review in the city of Mesa. So with this morning, I have Veronica Gonzalez, who is our project manager, and Rachel Prelog, who's our senior planner. They've been the leading staff that have basically been undertaking this project. So with that, I'll pass it on to Veronica.
Good morning, Mayor, Council members. As you know, on November 4th, 2014, the citizens of Mesa voted to approve the Mesa 2040 General Plan, which establishes a vision for Mesa that we become a recognizable city with a strong sense of place, and that also our built environment become the standard for quality and the envy of other communities. To implement the vision of the general plan, we have tools that we can use, such as the zoning ordinance, sub-area plans, community plans, desert uplands design guidelines, and residential design guidelines. Specific plans like the Central Main Plan, the Falcon Field sub-area plan, and Eastmark and Cadence community plans have done a pretty good job of getting us the quality that we desire in the city of Mesa. However, it's in the areas of the cities where we currently do not have a specific sub-area plan or community plan, where we're finding that the existing tools that we currently have been insufficient in producing that level of quality that we want to see here in the city of Mesa. So as a result, the city initiated a project to create quality development design guidelines. The goals of this project are to establish clear expectations for quality development. We want to encourage flexibility and innovation. We want to establish a consistency in applying those design standards. And then we also want to adopt text amendments to support those quality development design standards. Public outreach and feedback was a very important component to this project. So we held public outreach events that included 3 community workshops, 1 developer workshop, 2 development advisory forums, and 2 online surveys, which in total resulted in more than 500 participants in this project. The key elements the participants wanted to see in the quality development design guidelines included architectural variety and diversity in building types. They wanted to see the use of quality building materials and paint colors, outdoor spaces that are landscaped and shaded, and pedestrian connectivity and walkability. Beyond those desired elements from the community, the development community also provided some specific feedback on what they'd like to see in the design guidelines. Those elements included making sure that we consider a variety of design options, that we allow for flexibility, we consider site context, and that we promote consistency in review. With this feedback from the citizens and the development community, staff began drafting the quality development design guidelines, and we formatted them into 3 main categories, 1 for residential, commercial, and industrial, to address the 3 main types of developments we see in the city of Mesa. So with the residential design guidelines, we want to create resilient neighborhoods that stand the test of time. So the residential guidelines include principles that encourage projects that create a sense of place and neighborhood identity, open spaces and amenity areas that are centrally located and include a network of pedestrian connections, architectural styles that create an interesting streetscape that focus on the main entrance to the home rather than the garage face, and of course the use of quality building materials. The commercial design guidelines include elements that encourage buildings that engage the street with pedestrian-scaled architecture, cohesive building design and group developments, designs that create a sense of arrival, gathering spaces, amenities designed for pedestrians, and the use of coordinating variety building materials and paint colors. Industrial developments are often characterized by large parking lots and buildings that are dominated with loading and service areas. However, with the design guidelines, the elements that apply to industrial developments can positively contribute to the overall character of the area. So these elements you'll find in the industrial design guidelines include using massing and scale to break up large buildings, encouraging smaller groupings of parking spaces, a mixture of building materials and colors, and placing loading and service areas interior to the site so they are not visible from public view.
Good morning, Mayor Giles and council members. As Nana mentioned earlier, the development of these design guidelines and text amendments were really informed by research of national best practices and then research of our surrounding communities and what standards they have. So staff researched if other communities around us had adopted design guidelines, what sort of topics were included in those, and whether those standards were codified within their zoning ordinance. So the graphic you're seeing on the screen before you shows the number of design standards that have been codified in various jurisdictions' zoning ordinances. As you can see, Mesa has the fewest number of design standards in our zoning ordinance, and this may be one reason why we're not seeing the quality development that other cities are getting right now. For the main part, the quality development that we have seen can be largely attributed to planned area development overlay districts, which require superior design as an offset for flexibility and relief from zoning standards. So what staff is proposing is a set of amendments to accompany the design guidelines that would really create this baseline of standards within the zoning ordinance. So on the screen before you are all the chapters that would be affected by these amendments, but the majority of the changes would really be contained to the residential, commercial, and mixed use and employment district chapters. These can be summarized as organizational changes where there is removal of repetitive language. There is moving of text from one chapter to another where it's more appropriate. And then just within the chapters themselves, some reorganization as new standards and language is added. And then for the more substantive changes, we have the inclusion of new language for new standards to go along with the design guidelines. We have added specificity to the existing standards that existed already. We have new definitions to go along with some terms that have been introduced. And then we have the inclusion of an alternative compliance procedure, which allows for some flexibility and allows for alternatives to be proposed in lieu of specific design standards. So staff went to Planning and Zoning Board on October 23rd. They did recommend unanimous approval of the design guidelines and text amendments. So our next step is to come back before you on December 2nd for the adoption, hopefully, of the design guidelines and the introduction of the text amendments, and then return to you on December 9th for adoption of the text amendments. So with this, staff is proposing a 60-day implementation. So any applications received prior to February 10th would be reviewed with our current zoning ordinance. Anything after that would have to adhere to the new standards. And then in light of that, if we have the adopted design guidelines and text amendments, if we receive any pre-application, which is kind of the conceptual review, we would be giving them feedback at that time of what the new standards would be so they aren't surprised by that and can expect what they would need to provide with their formal applications. So this concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Luna.
And Veronica, on slide 8, said residential design guidelines. You have interesting streetscapes. What exactly does that mean? Do you have a definition? Is it aesthetically pleasing? Or do you have some, just a little bit more language on that? So, because to me, that doesn't really tell the story and what you're trying to achieve.
Mayor, Councilmember Luna, in the design guidelines portion of the project, which is the more aspirational, inspirational side of things, what we mean when we talk about interesting streetscapes, we're not looking to have repetitive home elevations down the street, one after the other. As we get into the zoning ordinance or the text amendment part of it, which is where we have that specificity, is where we will get into actual specifics on what that is. And
sure. So Mayor Giles, Councilmember Luna. So within the text amendments, there would be requirements that you couldn't have the same elevation next to each other or across the street from each other. I will add that the language here for the interesting streetscapes is not part of the design guidelines or in the zoning ordinance. That's more of just kind of language we had for the slides. But it really is intended to provide that variety on the street, some interest that you're not having the cookie cutter homes next to each other.
Yes.
Well, on the same slide, subordinate garages, I get the emphasis on trying to de-emphasize the garage as the prominent feature from the streetscape, but can you just, what's another, how do you subordinate a garage? I'm trying to figure out what that looks like.
Mayor Giles, I would say how you described it of de-emphasizing the garage is exactly the intent that we're trying to get across, so this was just another word we were trying to express that in, so we can kind of switch that language if you find it more
appropriate. I like it. I'm just trying to think about it. Yeah, and so it's probably not going to be
pushing it back.
Okay, right. Or tilting it or finding other ways or maybe emphasizing the entrance as opposed to the garage, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Mayor,
so
that's correct.
Trying to prevent having what they call a snout garage that protrudes, and it's the main feature that you would see of the home.
Right. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Mr. Thompson.
Actually, your timeline is off by about 4 years because I think we started working on this and sat like 5 years ago. But I'm glad we finally got to this point to where we're updating our guidelines. You know, because forever we have been doing things the same, and I often said, you know, you only have to start at the Pinal County Maricopa border and drive west all the way to Buckeye, and you can't tell really what city you're entering and which city you're leaving, because every house is stucco and tile and looks exactly the same. And so I really have been pushing for these design guidelines. I've been on you, so thank you for getting this done to change that, so that we have something different in Mesa. But at the same time, we also are allowing the developers and the builders to have some confidence that they can come into Mesa and they can try something different that's working maybe on the East Coast or in another city somewhere outside of Arizona that could work here, and not be afraid to do that. And we should have opened a mind enough to be able to allow that. I'm glad you're also on the commercial side and the industrial side, that you're looking at the parking. That's one of, you know, that's one of my pet peeves is when you drive by a Super Target and 90% of the parking lot's empty, and when we could have pads out there with restaurants or retail on them, you know, driving sales tax revenue in an otherwise vacant lot. So I'm glad that we're taking a look at that and starting to maybe consider shrinking down the amount of parking that we are mandating be out there. So thanks for putting this together. I think this will help set us apart. One of the things I often say to Nana and to Bill Jibjiniak, when we meet is, you know, I'm tired of taking all the things that other cities are throwing away just because it's easier to build it in Mesa. And so I think there's an expectation now that the other cities should take the stuff that we throw away, that, you know, that they're not deserving enough to be in our city. And we want to expect a higher level of quality and not mediocre, mediocrity in our city. So thank you for putting this together.
Jen.
Yes, thank you for putting together the design standards. As Councilmember Thompson mentioned, I think it's been a need and a want from our residents and from council. On this slide here in pedestrian connections, I would like to advocate for minimizing or maybe even eliminating cul-de-sacs and circles and things that create the mazes, especially in master plan communities, because it really forces the traffic onto connector streets. And so you have a lot of traffic on those connectors, because if you want to visit your neighbor on the other side of the fence, you can't walk there. You got to get in your car and drive maybe a quarter mile. It doesn't have a lot of connections to throughout the neighborhood, which discourages biking and walking and everything like that. It just pushes everybody to those connector streets and encourages driving when it's not necessary.
Mayor, Council, Councilmember Duff, that's a good point. This will require a lot of research and looking at our landscape in the city of Mesa and all the vacant parcel, and also we will have to have a very thorough discussion with our engineering department to make sure that those requirements, we may have to amend other standards beyond just what is even in the text, the zoning ordinance. So that's well noted. We will pursue that in the coming months as well and look at, because right now, this is just the beginning. There are other things that we're working with engineering group, and we will add this to the list of things to bring it back to you in a later date.
Yeah, I understand that you need to work it in with all the other objectives to make sure that it is a, you know, safe and enjoyable neighborhood. And I appreciate having the interesting streetscapes, because for me, walking is always perceived by how enjoyable or how safe that walk is. And if it's, you know, if I don't feel like it, feel like it's a horrible walk, it's just like, okay, I'm going to drive that quarter mile. It's not something I really want to do, and we need to encourage that. Speaking of parking lots, especially in commercial areas of retailers, one of my pet peeves is being, if you even drive in there as a pedestrian or if you're biking, how you feel very unsafe, and you have to be on your guard or watching other cars that are back out and stuff to encourage safe walking spaces in that, and don't feel like your life is always in hand, you know, in jeopardy. Let's see. I would say my other thing that I'm big on, which I know that you already know, but I'll say it again, is on, you know, the shade factor, which any design community input that I go to, that's the number one thing that always comes up, is the shade factor. And our city is not, you know, our cities will grow warmer before, just because of the climate change. So when I looked at, I was involved with a study through Rail Mesa of looking at heat mitigation and urban heat and how to do that. If you look at a map of the city, the most hot areas, the highest temperatures actually are in our most impoverished areas. And so we need to focus on what we can do to mitigate that heat. Overall, as a city, I would like to see us implement shade as, I know we have it as a priority, but I would like to have some kind of measurement of that. So as we have new development or redevelopment, that we look at trying to achieve a 25% or a 30% would be even more great, in order to have shade on each of our properties and areas and connections and parks and everything. If we can achieve that area by area, we can cool that area by 5 degrees, which is substantial when you think about our heat in the summer. So whatever we can do to work towards having some minimum standards for shade, and then also promote it with our residents to think about their own lots and what they control, if they can start implementing, and there's programs for trees or there's structures or whatever we can do to put that as a priority in our city.
Mayor, Councilmember Duff, good points. Actually, one of the major feedbacks that we got from the Planning and Zoning Board once we started this discussion was for us to go back and include providing shade and other landscape areas as part of the proposed text amendments and the design guidelines. So we included some, but based on also our conversation with you, one of the requirements now in the text amendment is for us to require maximum lot coverage for certain zoning districts, which in the past we did not have. So what it means is you can develop to a certain max, and then the rest of the site needs to be left for landscaping, which will provide, basically will help reduce the heat islands. But shading and landscaping is one of the things that it continue to be a major thing that we'll continue to work on and look into it as well.
Yeah, I know we have requirements for landscaping, but within that landscaping, we can also look at if those and providing some shade. And I think it helps reduce energy costs, it provides some social equity, and increases our quality of life. The study that was done through Nature's Conservancy and Partners is on the railmesa.org website, the full study, if you'd like to reference it. And then on the design guidelines, does this apply to like a remodel existing properties? Or
Mayor, Council, yes and no. And the yes part is it depends on the extent of the remodeling. So our zoning ordinance has a definition of what is a major amendment or major change. So based on the extent of the change, certain requirements kicks in, and if it's just minor change, then they may not have to conform. But one of the things we're going to do is with the design guidelines, we're going to encourage people, because this is the text amendments, those are basically requirements you have to meet. The guidelines opens up standards and negotiations that we can encourage people, and that's one of the things we've actually started doing before even this goes into effect. When people come in, we tell them, hey, look on our website, look at our design guidelines, what we're trying to achieve, because in one of the common questions we do get is, what are you guys looking for? Whenever we even have our first contact with applicants or people interested, their first question becomes that. So with the remodeling, there are specific requirements, but we'll continue to encourage people to really basically uplift those areas that do not meet the standards.
Great. Thank you for the work you do. I think you're going in the right direction. I'm excited to have this going on. Thank you.
Francisco.
Councilwoman Duff took my question around the remodeling development side. I know we have, based on recent experience, a lot of, especially on the industrial side, a lot of old industrial stock, right? If folks are wanting to redevelop or, you know, change the aesthetics to their locations to get more clients in, just if you can expand from your comments there. And then second question, as far as the rollout of these standards, what's the role to the developers, the community, what's the plan there? Because moving from the 7 on the codified standards to 21 is a big change. And so what's a plan to ensure that folks are first aware, and then also what's that they're, you know, meeting these standards as they come in with plans? And so those are my two questions.
Mayor, Council Member Heredia. So the first question as to whenever a proposed remodeling comes in, what are the standards or the requirements? We have what we called in our zoning ordinance, substantial conformance improvement plan. So basically that requirements gives us the opportunity to work with the applicant to bring the site to the most effective and possible conformance to our standards. And basically there are certain things that, because the site is already existing, they cannot basically alter the site to meet those standards. However, we work with them to make sure that things like if you can reduce parking spaces on your lot to provide required landscaping, we work with them to do that. if you're basically removing the elevations or repainting or doing some modeling to the elevations, we work with them to make sure you come close to our standards as much as possible. And what this is going to do is, it's been a bit challenging when we're talking to them about standards and we don't have much. We needed the tools. We continue to ask for the tools to help us basically have this, because one of the things we believe is there are specific standards that the development community or anyone that wants to develop needs to meet. But having strong collaborative and negotiating with them is one of the best tools that we can actually continue, because they may not be able to meet certain standards today, but once they see the pursuit for quality in the next development that they will be able to meet those standards, it makes it easy to really get there. So that's my answer to that question. And in terms of the rollout, so we've had extensive discussion and communication with the development community, with various stakeholders. We've met so many times with Jackson Mall. And so everyone knows exactly what we are doing. And that one of the recommendations from the development community is what is leading to us recommending the effective date to be February, because typically our ordinance, it takes 30 days for it to go into effect. But based on our discussion with them, there are certain projects that they've started designing and they recommended that we add 30 more days to it. So they are very aware. In addition, we will send an email out again, sending them the approved requirements once council approved. So there will be communication out to the development community for them to be aware. Thanks.
Let me just add my thanks. I know you've been working very hard on this. I appreciated the field trip you took me on a few weeks ago to see some good examples of some of the better designs that we're trying to do more of, and particularly in the industrial areas in the parking. It was obvious to me that there's clearly a better way, and there's examples, good examples in our community that we're trying to do more of. So thank you for working on this. Here's an odd question for you. I know off and on over the last year or two, sometimes we get into disagreements with developers over drive-throughs, fast food drive-throughs, and we want to de-emphasize, you know, the vehicles and in front of the restaurants. But I noticed recently another drive-through that was redeveloped put in a redevelopment area, Mesa Drive and Brown, the Burger King. And I was sitting there the other day and I thought, wow, I think I could order, you know, right. I was in the intersection, but I felt like I was in the drive-thru. And I thought, it seems like we're a little sporadic in where we enforce this, you know, de-emphasis of vehicles in the front. And are we, is this something that's going to be addressed in these guidelines?
Rachel answer the question.
Mayor Giles, that is something that we addressed in the text amendment. So as part of that, we are proposing that the drive-throughs cannot be along the arterials there. So they would not be able to be just adjacent, abutting to the arterials. So that is one of those elements that we are addressing in there.
So that hasn't been part of our code prior to these amendments. That's been addressed in certain parts of town where we were emphasizing design. Is that correct?
Yes, it was not part of the zoning ordinance before, and it was, you know, more of negotiations with staff of trying to de-emphasize that drive-through lane and get the building closer to the street.
Well, and I'd like to say amen to some of the things Jen said about the walkability of residential neighborhoods. Week ago, we had the opportunity to visit a lot of neighborhoods and go to the block parties on game night, and particularly when I go to some of the newer master plan communities like Eastmark, there's just a real sense of community, you know, in those neighborhoods, and you can really attribute it to the design of how these homes face each other, you know, the shared amenities that they have, the kind of engineered to have interaction with people. So I think there has been a lot of progress made in how you design a neighborhood, and so I hope that these guidelines incorporate some of that.
Yes. Just to that point, we do our best. It's interesting, the pushback doesn't usually come from the developers. It often comes from the neighbors who live in those subdivisions and people walking through. especially. So
they don't want a lot of pedestrian traffic.
No, we've had that happen at a few places. So I think they're okay connecting to other parts of the neighborhood. It's when where we really see the value, kind of like Councilmember Duff was mentioning, is how do you connect them to, like, if there's like the commercial, you know, stores or whatever, grocery stores on the outside of the subdivision. And we're thinking, well, it makes sense. Let's make sure that we have pedestrian connections into those centers so they don't have to get in their car and drive around and go back in. Well, usually the pushback comes from the residents. We have it even when we're trying to get people or children to schools and people complaining about that. So it's a balance, and I think we need to keep pushing it. I just want the council to get a heads up that it's sometimes the pushback actually comes. It's not the residents in the interior, it's the residents closest to where that activity is taking place. So sometimes we have to look at the security issues and how that blends together. And so it can be done. It's not as simple as punching a hole through the wall and opening it up. It does have to take some balancing with all parties involved. So.
Just to that point, I don't want to deliberate this too much because I know we have a lot on our agenda, but there is the offset is congestion of cars in the neighborhoods. And as we all know, pedestrian deaths occur far too often. I think we're one of the highest in the nation for pedestrian deaths. And the reason for that is that we are so dependent on our cars to do absolutely everything. To walk to school that might be two blocks away, that we have to drive a mile, things like that. So I think there's a little bit, I don't want to push back to say the residents are wrong. I think what we need to do is start having a conversation as to what the offsets are, what the pros and cons, and then take that into consideration, because I don't think we really realize what we're doing until we start complaining about the traffic. But if we remember back to, like, when I was a kid, like, we, as a neighborhood and the kids, we walked to school, and things were in a direct line, a direct course. They weren't in a maze that, you know, tripled the distance. And so I think there's some balance there of having safe neighborhoods and having a walkable and bikeable and reduce the congestion because of the design. So
Thank you. Jeremy.
I just want to comment on that. I sat on my HOA board for multiple years, and I think one of the biggest complaints that we got, we sit next to a commercial complex, and to what Chris was saying, one of the biggest complaints for people were that people would cut through our neighborhood because we had a hole in the wall to get to the commercial, and like they don't want to see people in their neighborhood that they don't recognize, whether that be right or wrong. So I think if we're going to find a balance here, then it needs to be localized in the sense that the people that are living in these communities need to have the ability to decide if they want, you know, people coming through their neighborhoods, because we've made it so porous for them to for people to get through the neighborhood. So I just want to make that point. You know, it doesn't seem to me that a lot of people that live next to these, you know, like a commercial thing or whatever, want more people traveling through their neighborhood. When they see people they don't recognize, they actually frown upon that, right? So we can find a balance, but if we're going to punch a hole through a brick wall or force that if neighborhoods remodel, then it should be an option for a gate or some other means for them to close that gate if that neighborhood decides that they don't want people flowing through their community.
To that point, I understand the commercial aspect, but we have seas of miles and miles and miles of residential and huge areas where there is no business involved, but you cannot navigate within those neighborhoods. The master plan communities, they might have 10 neighborhoods within the master plan, and you cannot navigate even sometimes within the same subset without a lot of driving back to the connect road, back to this one, and then to go over here. So within the residential area, those are the connections that we can keep our neighborhoods engaged and make it more walkable and bikeable so we can be more neighborly and not be in our cars all the time, which are a certain danger to that too.
Great point.
Well, thank you. So we'll look forward to having this come back to council and moving forward December the 2nd.
Thank you
very much.
Actually, I have questions.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I wasn't finished. What are the legal implications of these requirements? Is this something that all developers will be forced to, will they be confined to these policies once these put in place if any new development comes through the city?
Yes, so this will be the design guidelines. It's a guideline that is going to be, depending on your decision, will be by resolution. And then the text amendments will be a zoning ordinance which will enforce or guide any proposed development coming in. You will have to conform to those standards. However, there are certain alternative routes or strategies that is in the plan. So sometimes we may have a development that is so unique that it may not be able to absolutely conform to the absolute standards. So there are alternative ways. But back to your question, yes, this is part of the zoning ordinance, so any development will have to conform to the standards.
And so if a developer decided had something that was outside of these standards, then I'm assuming the process would be like a P&Z rezoning where they go through the P&Z board, it comes before council, and things could be overridden through a council vote, or would
So we have the planned development areas, PAD, basically, which gives the alternative. If you come in and you think you have a proposal that is superior than our standards or you need certain flexibility, they have the option to do the PAD, which will be recommended by P&Z, and it will come to council for final decision.
Okay. Superior than the standards you're setting. So let's say a developer comes before us and they're like, we want to shrink the sizes of the garages because we need more profit on this community that we're making, and we can fit more houses if we shrink the garage sizes. Is that something that's going to go before P&Z and then come before council, or will it be automatically denied based on some legal requirement?
They will have to. So the way to vary from those standards will typically through the PAD route, and it will go to P&Z and come to council. But one of the requirements for the PAD specifically is to make sure your proposal is superior and there is basically substance to why you're requesting the changes, and not because you just want to basically develop anything and do not want to meet the standard. That's why you're going through the PAD route. In that case, our recommendation will be denial, and it will be up to the council to make the final decision.
Great. So if any decisions come, if any of the things that developers are proposing are, if you feel they are inferior to the standards that we're setting, staff recommendation is always going to be denial then before as it comes to council.
So we look at, we look at the situation and we look at based on case by case basis, but with these standards, we're going to hold to the standards, and our recommendation more likely in most of those instances is going to be denial.
Okay. And based on these standards, I guess the one thing that my opinion would be, and I don't know if you guys have already, first of all, I appreciate the time that you guys have put into what you've done so far, but I believe that we should go back and look at communities that are 30, 40, 50 years old and look at the median house value of those communities that have aged, you know, over decades and say, well, what standards or what characteristics are present in these neighborhoods? And we should probably be implementing those same standards in the neighborhoods that we're pushing out into the future, right? So I hope that that's part of the process in which we've created these.
Mayor, council member, we definitely considered that. So if you look at the neighborhoods like Dobson Ranch, some of the older neighborhoods that have actually lasted, that has been sustainable, there are basic elements that we really looked into and considered. So when we took some of the council on a tour, we went to some of those neighborhoods and identified there are certain elements in those neighborhoods that has helped those neighborhoods to be sustainable. And so we did consider them, and we continue to evaluate them as well over time. So
great. And have we addressed, I apologize if it's already in here, is there something related to density as far as like smaller houses or houses that only have 6 feet between property lines?
Mayor, council, so one of the ongoing projects that we've been meeting weekly is actually we're looking at our standards for small lot development, which is not part of this. So basically that will address density and make sure that there is a balance between increasing density and setting standards, both planning and engineering standards. But in addition, I'll pass it on to Rachel to answer some of the small lot requirements that we are asking now.
Mayor Giles, Councilmember Whitaker. So as part of the text amendments, there were changes to the residential chapter where previously the single residence homes and the small lot residential were separated because in order to do small lot residential, you had to provide superior quality. So a lot of the design standards that we're talking about, there was kind of a list that you had to provide in order to create these smaller lots. So with these revisions, since we're considering these a baseline standard now, that has been removed. So those chapters or those sections have been combined. So that would be the expected standard now. So the point that I'm getting to is that they no longer can provide quality as an incentive to do those small lots. That's going to be an understood requirement now. So that may discourage some of that small lot development that has been occurring. That makes sense?
Not 100% following you. So part of this will be getting rid of... You used to be able to use quality to override small lots, but you're saying that will no longer be the case. You're sort of getting rid of small lots entirely?
Mayor, Council, so in the past or our current regulations, there was this assumption that if you want to do smaller lots, you need to provide higher quality. To Rachel's point, right now, those that used to be perceived as higher quality is going to be our standard. And so if you want to do small lot, you will have to provide certain standards that is beyond the current standards. In addition, most likely those are reviewed as plan area development, which means you need to provide something that is superior. So if you are providing smaller lots, you may have to provide larger open space areas where cumulatively, overall, it basically meets certain density. And so those are going to be trade-offs that we will be looking for.
Great. I've seen when you bring, but they have small lots, you may require them to have community centers or larger open spaces so that while they don't have the larger backyard, there's a community area where that takes place. And those kinds of amenities are shared versus having them separated per lot.
That's absolutely fair? Correct, okay. Yes.
So that's how we've tried to manage that offset, I guess.
Okay. And you've looked at other communities that have been aging that use the same concept, and those communities are retaining their value then? Is that the logic behind that?
We did. I can tell you, Veronica and Rachel probably can cite almost 10 or 11 codes in the metro area right now. They've done a lot of review and research, so we've done a thorough research.
Awesome. Well, thanks for putting this together, guys. I appreciate it.
Yes, Jen.
As you can tell, planning is something I care about. I think we have to think differently about how we think about density. It used to be density was a bad word, but in today's market, affordable housing, or being able to afford a house, let's put it that way, being able to buy a house and buy even that first house is becoming more difficult and more difficult. And as we grow as a city and have a higher population, we will have the need to be more dense. And otherwise, our other choice is to continue the sprawl, which is we're going to run out of space. It contributes to a number of expenses and factors in our environment and in the infrastructure we have to put in. So especially in the more developed parts of the city, we have to think about density as a chosen way to live. Whether you're getting started, whether you're retiring, whether you don't want 2,000 square feet to live in, we have to think about it differently. It doesn't necessarily mean lower price or lower quality. Lower quality and lower price aren't necessarily the same thing. But it is a way that we have to look at our future of living more dense, living more smart, living so that we don't have to be faced with the point of evictions and homelessness and or just being a slave to a mortgage payment. So we have to be very smart about how we use our space, but density is not a bad thing. It needs to be mixed so we have a variety to offer all residents, whether they want single family, if they want a multi-family environment, property or not, a mix of all things. But doing things or talking about density as bad is, I think, not the way of the new urban movement or moving into the 21st century, is living more smart and living differently than we have before. Thank you.
Mayor, Councilmember Duff, so we do look at, whenever we have a proposed development, we look at all that. We look at the infrastructure that is available to support the density, because most of the time that is also critical to the type of density you can have. And as we continue to also have that discussion with the community development as to provide a mix of housing, those are the things that we're looking into. And when it comes to the downtown area, we continue to have discussion with Jeff as to which are the areas in our inner core that can support certain density. So overall, that's something we continue to do, to look at our needs and have a balance comprehensively. So,
great. Well, thanks again. We've got some great neighborhoods in Mesa, but I keep harkening back to our experience last Saturday with Gain. I visited a few homes in Frankie's neighborhood. These were some original Dobson Ranch residents. So they moved in the early 70s, and the neighborhoods were still beautiful. And everyone was out in the streets, and they were talking about how much they loved their neighborhood. And I think that's what we're striving for, isn't it, is to have those kind of neighborhoods that can be sustainable, that stand the test of time. I think there's a lot of good in what you've proposed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item on our agenda is item 1B. That's to hear a presentation and discuss the city's advanced metering infrastructure project, also known as smart meters. We got the dream team, Candace and Jake and Frank.
We're wearing the same shirt.
That's right.
They're going bowling.
Yeah. Are the balls in the car? Okay.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. So yes, we do have a dream team here in the city of Mesa, and it's a dream that we've had for quite some time, which is advanced metering infrastructure. The old name used to be automated meter reading back in the day, and we've kind of advanced that. It's a little bit more high tech now than it used to be when we were looking at it previously. So what we'd like to do is kind of give you an update on where we are on this project for the city. It is one of our Smart City Initiative projects. Travis Cutright came in and talked with you about our Smart City Initiative, and we have many different projects in the city that is under that Smart City Initiative, and this is one of those projects related to utilities and using data. So just as a real quick reminder of what a smart city is, so the smart city is a city that leverages technology to improve the services that we deliver to our residents, and also just to improve the overall quality of life within the city. And so when we're looking at it, it's kind of a combination of technology and data, but it's for the benefit of the residents, and that's the point, is how do we use that data to make the city better? So advanced metering infrastructure, you'll hear us kind of refer to that as AMI sometimes, but really is also known as smart meters. And so we'll probably start using the term smart meters. It means a little bit more to our residents and to our employees when we talk about smart meters and what those are. So really, what is a smart meter? So a smart meter is really just the meter that's on your house already. It's your electric, your gas, or your water meter. Although it has the ability to actually take the read of the usage of that commodity on its own, meaning it doesn't need a meter reader to go out and actually read the meter. So we can actually take the read on a predetermined amount of time. We'll be looking at that. What is that amount of time we want to do it? Is it every 7 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, every hour? And we'll be looking at that. So the meter can actually take that read when we want it to, and then transmit that information, that data, back to a central hub or a central location for us to be able to use that data for consumption, for looking at it. The city can use it, as well as the account, the resident as well, can take a look at their usage. Okay. So in essence, that's really what a smart meter is. The technology that's changed going forward is that our smart meters now, back in the day, the automated meter reading was just taking reads. With today's technology, we now have the ability to do two-way communication, meaning that we have that ability to also possibly do remote turn on and turn off of accounts. And that's going to save us rolling a truck and a crew to go out and do those remote location turn on and turn offs. So those are items that we'll be looking at as well as part of this project. This one, I just want to give you a real quick, we won't spend a lot of time on this, but just kind of how does a smart meter work? Really, it's taking the read again. It's taking the read of the usage at that particular household or commercial. And it's sending it to a collector. There's a collector that's collecting all that data and then sending it back to the main location. There are a couple different ways. This particular illustration shows what we call, point to multipoint. So this is our point to multipoint, meaning all the meters are actually going to a collector, and then that data is being sent back to the city. There's also another one that we'll be looking at as well, which is a mesh network, and that's where the meters can actually talk to each other and then go to the collector. So there's a couple different communication methods. We'll be, as part of this project, we'll be looking at both of those methods and probably doing a combination of those depending on what the needs of the city are. You know, our city is very geographically large, and so each area may have its own pros and cons to different communication networks that we'll use within that city. What are the benefits of smart meters? So we see a lot of benefits to the city for smart meters or installing smart meters within the city. So there's a combination of both the increased efficiency of knowing what our system is doing and not rolling those trucks that we talked about. So instead of having our meter readers going out physically, looking at every meter and taking those reads once a month, we'll actually be able to do this remotely, so we won't need the physical people going out anymore. And also we'll have access to more data. So instead of getting a read just once a month, again, we'll be getting those reads more often. That'll allow our staff to actually look at the system and see how the system is working. It'll allow our staff to look at if there's, for example, a leak on the water side. We'll be able to see that faster. It'll help the residents to be able to see a leak as well. If they have a leak on their property, rather than waiting to get that very large bill at the end of the month, they'll be able to see that their usage has gone up drastically very quickly, and then be able to take care of that before they've had a leak for a whole month and maybe didn't know about it. So there's a lot of different things there. We also have improved accuracy of our meters. We'll be able to see right now if a meter is maybe falling behind. If the accuracy of the water meter has changed, if behavior patterns have changed over time, and that would allow water staff to go out and maybe replace that one meter that's not performing rather than waiting until that neighborhood is planned to replace all of the meters at one time. So it'll really help us take a look at our meter replacement policy and our program and be more accurate and specific on which meters that we replace rather than just replacing them because they've aged a particular age. I should be able to focus in on those as well. The other thing is just timely access to the data. So smart meters, when we look at this, it'll have a software package that actually allows the resident to go in and see their consumption. So they can log into their account. They'd be the only ones who can log in and see that. We are looking at security as well. We understand security and everything that comes along with data. So they'd be able to go in and log into their account and actually see what their usage patterns are and maybe do some conservation. Or if they put a new appliance in and they want to go and see how that's doing on their electric. Did that shoot their electric up or did that bring their electric down? So it'll actually allow our residents and our customers to better manage the consumption of those commodities as well.
Got a question here. I just got confused. Yep. Are we talking about water smart meters or electric or both combined?
We are actually talking about three different, both electric, gas, and water. Okay. So all the meters within our inventory.
Yes, Mr. Luna.
So Candace, are we working with SRP as well? Because, you know, where I live, SRP is our provider, and then Southwest Gas for gas, or how is that working? How is that going to work out?
Yeah, Mayor and Councilmember Luna, this project here is just looking at replacing the city's meters. Okay. But we are in discussions. We've talked with them about how they're doing their project, and we're going to be talking to everybody who's already done this to make sure that we're learning lessons learned from them as well. For this particular project is just City of Mesa meters. So it would be the electric area, just the downtown area, and then our gas, including our magma area for natural gas, and then citywide for water meters. So back in 2018, we actually had a consulting company come in, Utility Works Consulting LLC, and they came in and did a feasibility study for the city, interviewed our staff and our departments, did an inventory of our meters that were out there, our inventory of meters, as well as our service area, pros and cons and those types of things, and did a feasibility study for us. And the result of that feasibility study, they basically said that the city of Mesa is in a prime time right now to implement smart meters. They worked with all four. There are four departments that are very vital to this particular project, and that is our water resources, energy resources, business resources for our billing and customer interface, as well as our information technology department to actually help us put it all together. So through that, the results showed that a return on investment would be about, for if we included all three utilities in this project, would be a 12 to 13 year return on investment for this project. It also determined that we're just well situated when it comes to infrastructure, and we're going to talk about that next, and the infrastructure we have and how does that help us in leveraging smart meters. So on this map here, you can see this is a map of our current fiber infrastructure. So the city of Mesa over the last few years has been diligently investing in fiber within our city limits. And you can see on this map, all of the blue on the map is fiber lines that are already within the city, already constructed. And then the red ones are the ones that were part of that 2018 bond, and they'll be constructed over the next couple of years. And so that really shows just the expanse of fiber that we have already in the city, which really puts us at an advantage to other municipalities who have not invested in fiber and are going to be relying basically on cell technology or some type of over-the-air type technology. In addition to our fiber lines, we've also done an inventory of all of our other physical assets here within the city of Mesa. And so while this is a little, got a lot going on here, at the end of the slides, you can see them individually if you want to see those individual assets. So I did include those at the end of the slide deck. But right here, we kind of, what basically you're seeing here is between our communication towers, our cell towers, our light poles, our signals, all those types of things, you can really see we have a lot of physical assets here within the city that we can use to either place the collectors or replace a repeater, basically to create that communication network that we're looking to create. And so we'll be using those as well. So this was our original inventory, and we'll be doing a deep dive on this to truly get the characteristics of all those and pros and cons of how to place our communication network. So when we look at this project is very complicated because it does encompass all three of the meters that we have, the electric, the natural gas, and the water. It has multiple facets to it. One is the actual installation of the meters, and also you might hear us use the word endpoint. So it depends on an electric meter. The smart meter is all encompassed, so it's one meter with a smart meter embedded into it. When you're looking at natural gas or water, it's actually sometimes it's called an endpoint, but basically it's another component that's added to the meter. So a water or natural gas could be compatible and not have that point on it yet. So some of our water meters we've been doing over the last couple of years are actually smart meter compatible, and we would just need to add that component to it, not actually replace the whole meter. But for electric meters, because it all is all in one, it would be a replacement of every electric meter as part of this project. So that's kind of that combination there. We talked about the communication network. The thing with the communication network is we will be designing and implementing a communication network that will not just work for smart meters, but will also be able to piggyback other smart city initiatives onto that as well. So if we have other meters or sensors that we place elsewhere in the city, for example, if we want to do in the parks, we want to know how many people are going in and out of a park, and we want to place sensors there and then feed that back, that would ride on this same communication network. So when we're building and looking at this network is not just for the smart meters. It's to build it to the capacity that it can be used for other smart city initiatives within the city. And then the other section, the large section on this project, is actually what do we do with the data once we have it? Because just the collection of data in and of itself does not help the city. So we want to leverage that, and that is it's called a meter data management system, you'll hear us say, MDMS sometimes, if we slip and use an acronym, that's what we're talking about. And that's really the collection, that's sending all of that data back to the city It's in one location, and then now what do we do with that? So that's actually interfacing with our computer information system, which is actually our billing system. So how do we create bills with that data? We used to have one point, now we'll have multiple data points. Which data point is the billing data point? Those types of things. Interfacing with our customer portal. We currently have a customer portal that'll be coming up and running here in a little bit that is not to have the smart data. We'll just have the normal reads right now. How do we incorporate the smart data now into that portal, or do we need a new portal? Do we need to categorize it differently or set it up a little bit different? And that'll be happening as well. So all of those data management, data security, integration, all of that is a major component of this project as well. The project team has divided the project into two phases. So the first phase will actually incorporate two geographic locations. We'll talk about that in a minute. But a smaller number of meters, about 2,000 meters, we're going to include in the phase one. We'll talk about the goals of the phase one in just a minute. And then, so once we go through with the phase one and have everything up and running, interfaces and so forth, then we would move into citywide deployment. And so citywide deployment for us is phase two. So we're looking at it as a two-phase project.
I'm sorry, what's the timing of phase one and phase two?
I have a slide for that.
There we go. I'm sure you do.
So we're going to talk about phase one real quick. Just what are the goals of phase one? Why did we divide this into a phase one, into a citywide deployment? So for phase one, we're looking at two geographic locations. One is down here in the kind of downtown area where we have all three meters. We have electric, gas, and water. So we want to make sure that we're including households and commercial businesses that have all three meters. We have included a couple City of Mesa facilities as well that'll help us kind of work with those a little bit as well. And then the second area is going to be out in the Superstition Springs area where we've kind of looking for a neighborhood that has compatible meters to make sure that we can actually not have to change a meter and just add a component to it. And then another one that we would do a full change out. And so really in phase one, what we're looking for are what are those risks that we have in making sure that the technology and the equipment that we go with will work in all of those different areas. So we're limiting it to about 2,000 meters for our rollout of phase one, because we want to make sure that we're testing the system itself, the interfaces, the customer portal, and the billing. We want to make sure that everything works on those initial 2,000 meters before we start rolling it out to all of the other households and commercial businesses. We'll be determining the frequency of the data. Again, as we talked about, there are pros and cons with each meter, and each meter may not be the same. We may have different intervals that we are collecting data on from electric versus gas versus water. It also has to do with the equipment that we end up selecting, and the capacity. The more reads and the more transmissions, the shorter life of the battery of a particular meter. And so there's pros and cons there, and we'll be testing those and coming up with that kind of optimum spot for those. Again, we'll be looking at the transmission, how is it, the redundancy, the accuracy, making sure that we have redundant points. If a collector goes down, where is the data going to go to get back? So those are all the things that we're really, phase one is the full project. We're just doing it with only about 2,000 meters to make sure that it's working before we roll it out. So that's the basics on the phase one. A big piece of this, as we talked about, because it is three different commodities that we're looking at, three different types of meters, it involves four different departments within the city, as well as pulling in smart city initiatives and making sure that it's going to work with our smart city. For that, we've actually engaged a project management consultant to assist us in this project. So they will be a full-time project manager here working side by side with our team. Who has experience and expertise in smart meter implementations as well as just smart city initiatives in general. It gives us access to their technical advisors. So we'll have a technical advisor on site who will help us to design and lay out what our communication network needs to look like, help us to negotiate with the vendors, to read what their actual specs are, to understand what they can offer us or what they cannot offer us. As we go through the procurement process for the actual smart meter vendor.
Sorry, I thought you were going to switch slides.
Nope, not yet.
This Arcadis company, I'm assuming that they've done rollouts like this for municipalities of our size in all three of these categories, the water, electric and gas?
Yes, Mayor and Councilmember Whitaker, that was one of the requirements. We actually did a full RFP process for this consultant, and one of the requirements was they had to have done at least 5 implementations, and they had to have done one for at least something for each one of the commodities.
Okay, great.
So for that one, we have just signed. So we just are officially in contract with Arcadis. We just signed on October 31st last week. And so they will actually be on site this month, and we are starting with a bang. And so we'll have needs assessment workshops with staff members starting in just a couple of weeks. So we'll be going fast and furious on this project to get this project through. As part of that, we have put together 5 subject matter expert teams within the city to make sure, and a lot of these teams will be working side by side and parallel streams, if you look at it. So there'll be a lot going on with this project all at the same time. We'll have there's a team dedicated just to the metering aspect of it, the equipment, the installation, the oversight, the quality control. There's another team that's working on the technology and the security. So that's the actual communication network. How do we secure the data? How do we create the redundancies and the accuracies? Another team is working on integration and reporting. So again, that's the customer information system for billing. That's the customer portal, the configuration. Is it user-friendly? Making sure that all of that works on a timely basis. We also have a team that's working on the organizational change management and business processes. So this is a big change. It's going to be a big change for anyone in the city who has anything to do with the metering process. How will it change those business processes? So it's actually mapping out. Most of those have already been mapped up to this point. So we do have some folks from our performance excellence team who has been working with the utility areas to map out what their current business process is and where they think those changes, how they might change based on this. And then we know that communications is key in this project, because this is something that will touch every one of our customers and a lot of our employees. And so we actually have 2 communication teams that we've put together. One, the focus is on internal communication. How do we talk with our employees? How do we make sure that they are aware of how their job may or may not change with this, or how their processes may change? We also have a communications team that's focused on the external side, the residents, our customers. When and how do we communicate with them? What do we communicate when they know that their meters are going to be changed, and what does that mean? And how do we make sure that they know that they can now go and access a customer portal and actually look at their usage? You know, how do we educate them on their consumption and on that sort of thing? So those 5 teams will be working. Again, these are all parallel activities. Everything will be happening at the same time. And then we get to our project timeline. So, Mayor, here's your project timeline on where we are. The good and the bad, these types of projects don't happen overnight because it is complex with all 3 commodities, and we do have a very large city. Phase 1 is actually, while we'll only be implementing the 2,000 meters, we will still be designing the communication network for the entire city. And so you can see them here. The key dates for you is that we expect to come back to you in April of 2021 with a council award. I know it feels like that's kind of far away, but it will be here faster than you think. And obviously, if there are updates that you would like between now and then, we'd be happy to give you updates on our progression and where we are, whether it's formal or just, you know, informal, we can do that as well. But we do plan for April 2021 as our target date to be back to you for actual vendor award. And then we would start the implementation in May of 21. Going through all of phase 1, again, phase 1 includes all of the testing and implementation and integration. And then we hope to be at citywide implementation by March of 2022, so 1 year later, approximately.
Mr. Luna.
Thank you for doing this project. This is something that we badly need in our community. I like the fact that a resident can go into the website and see how much utilities are using water, gas, or whatever. So that's great that we'll be able to provide that service. Are we part of the Smart City? We're part of the Smart City Region Consortium. Are you going to be working with them, sharing the information that we're gathering?
This Mayor and Councilmember Luna, again, that's why we have our communication team and why we're kind of branching out into pretty much almost every department. Mm-hmm. We'll have something in here. But we do have a whole Smart City team mm-hmm. as well that's not listed here
yeah.
because it's not part of necessarily this project. We have a whole Smart City initiative team, and we'll be working very closely with them hand in hand. So any kind of a smart we'll be doing actually with our consultant we're going to be doing a roadmap for a smart city. So where do we want to go as a smart city? What type of initiatives are we looking for? What type of sensors are we looking for? Right. What type of data are we looking for? And then we want to make sure we're collecting that and then using the technical advisors that we have from Arcadis to help us put together the right communication network so that even if there's something that we're not doing today, if we think 5 years from now, we want to add something to our smart city initiatives. We want to make sure the communication network is set up today to accommodate that 5 years from now.
And we had a presentation from somebody at MAG talking about smart cities initiatives, and it's a consortium of a number of municipalities throughout the region. So, and we are part of that. So this is great data to collect with them and to share. But I'm a visual person. You know, I'd love to see what that smart meter looks like. If you could provide some images, I know by 2021 it's going to change. And then, you know, it's, you know, how are we going to power this? Are we going to use batteries in terms of especially the water? And then and the gas is probably located to the electricity. So that might be an easier way of gathering that data. So if you could send me pictures of what those things might look like. I know they're going to change, but I'm a visual learner. I just need to see what that's going to look like.
Mayor and Councilmember Luna, we'd be happy to send you. We have all sorts of pictures and all sorts of research that the team has already done.
Yeah.
And as you said, it's an emerging technology.
Right.
And so between now and next year, we could have even greater and better meters, but we can send you what we have so far.
Right.
Councilmember Luna, if you'd like, I mean, we can bring you what the meters look like today and the devices that we, a meter without the device and the meter with the device.
Right.
And so that's kind of like the technology. It's pretty simple on the water side
because
I'm just registering. So,
but. Well, you know, Jake, you were part of my presentation when I presented for the National League of Cities at our Hilo conference. And they were quite impressed that we were actually heading in that direction. Of course, we're a large city. We have a little bit more resources available to us. So this is a great idea. I want to continue sharing to our communities throughout the nation through NLC of what we're doing, and having more images and those kind of things are great things to tout. So please forward all that information. And as I go working with National League of Cities, I'd like to go ahead and share that.
We'll probably send you more than what you want.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks, Jake. Thank you.
And then, Mayor, just a real quick note on something that Councilmember Luna mentioned, too, is that as we talk about, you know, data is just not a one-city item. And so we're always looking at data sharing, just beyond even just whatever we collect within our city. We want to be able to talk to all the other cities. And so we actually have those networks already built for data sharing, and because data sharing is just a matter of making sure we're formatting our data. So we're all collecting data, but we need to format it in a way that normalizes it so that the data can talk to each other. So if we want to talk to Tempe or Chandler, we want to all pull our data together. We already have those networks built and those groups and those relationships that they're working as a region on how to normalize the data so that we can share it better. And that's just an extension of the smart cities.
Francisco.
Yep. Two items. One, just to clarify, you mentioned we do have the capacity to, along the portal side, both internally and externally, we're upgrading that portal sites to be able to take in all this data and for both staff and residents to look at those pieces, right? So that's my first question. Okay.
Yes, so Mayor and Councilmember, so we have a portal right now that's actually being introduced into the system right now with our current reads and so forth. And so Business Services is working on and IT is working on putting that together. When we go through this project, we're still probably a year out of knowing what kind of a portal we'll be looking at. But we'll be looking at both, one, do we leverage the existing portal that we have today or that's being implemented today? Because they do have, I believe they have a module that allows for smart meter data. Or do we go with the vendor that we go with? Do they have a customer portal as part of their software and part of their package? And so those would be one of the things that we will be evaluating is what is the best customer portal for our customers, you know, upgrading or their existing portal, or going with the vendor's portal, or going with the best in breed, which is there's this third party that just has this phenomenal portal that we want to look at. So those are all options for us going forward and part of this project.
And then my second point is on the communication side, and especially to our residents, external communications, any thought on maybe like testing, A-B testing certain communication methods, text, emails, other items to make our residents more aware of how they can utilize this technology as we're investing, I think it has a great opportunity for folks to reduce their bills and save them money in the long term. But if there's any thought to, you know, having those tests during this phase to learn and then maybe implement once we go citywide to a much larger system of how best our residents can utilize this technology for their advantage and save them money so that they can reduce their utility bills, right? So any thoughts to those pieces?
Yeah, Mayor and Councilmember Heredia, that's perfect. That's exactly what we're going to be doing as part of the communication team. So they'll be putting together a full communication master plan, if you will. And that was part of the selection of Arcadis. One of the requirements was that they do bring their experience, what they have experienced already in implementing these. We want their lessons learned, what went right, what went wrong. That includes the communication, because that is a key and vital piece of that. The one of the pros with Arcadis selection is that they actually have a local company here in Gilbert that they use for their communication efforts, and so we'll have access to a local resource to help us with that specializes. That's what he does. They specialize in communications. And so we'll have access to that one as well as just our staff on board as well. And that's exactly what we want to do in phase one. Is the goal of phase one is to have all of our processes down, to know how we're going to communicate, to know how they work, how we're going to deal with items and process improvements and so forth. We want all of that down by the time we finish our phase one. So when we get to citywide deployment, it really is just a rollout of additional meters. We've already discovered how we're going to do everything going forward.
I have a couple of questions. Is it okay,
Mayor? Yes, please.
Okay. On the phase one, on the implementation, so that is when all of it's integrated into our billing and everything. So between now and then, we'll be replacing meters, or when does the meter replacement occur? And we have three utilities, well, mostly in District 4.
Mayor and Councilmember Duff, the actual change out of the meters will be the start of the implementation, so that we would expect that to start about May of 2021 would be when the first meter would change. Because we would need to have the vendor on board, know what our vendor and our technology is, and then at that point we would go in and actually change out those 2,000 meters. And I think we're expecting that we could probably get those done within about 3 months, 3 to 4 months. We would have the 2,000 meters changed, and then the rest of that time would be testing, integration, communication network, all of those types of things, okay, as we make sure that that technology and that equipment will work and is the best for the city of Mesa.
Okay, now that I look at your timeline, it kind of, okay, software integration and testing. That, okay, so the implementation is the major changeover. And then I've had questions from constituents before about on their property. It was used in a different way prior, and then through remodels, they have multiple meters. They only need one sometimes, or they want to get rid of a meter. And I think that's been prohibitive. With the meter changes, does that provide an opportunity, or we're just, once a meter is in place, it's forever in place kind of thing?
Well, it's just they have to it's probably more the infrastructure and the plumbing and getting it
right
coming in. That's the challenge. It's the cost of consolidating the pipes to come
right
in.
And if you're talking about multiple meters, that would depend on, is one a gas meter, one's a water meter, and the other one's an electric meter? Yeah, there's not one meter that's going to be able
right
to do all three of those.
Do you mean multiple water or multiple gas on the same owner?
I know in the downtown area, specifically on a couple of conversations, it was the electric. I'm not sure on gas and water. Where properties had multiple apartments, and now they're redeveloped, and now they're one house with a guest house or something, and now they have to pay for two or three meters on a single property when there's only, or, you know, just different uses of the property where they're taking up more space and there was another meter there and they're having to pay the two service fees for everything, and when they only have one entity.
Well, the experiences that I've had with probably about 10 to 12 years ago started with a lot of people were realizing, hey, I can get a second meter and I can use that as a landscape meter, and then that way I'm not paying for sewer on it. And these are usually large properties that have a lot of grass. Or you've got a guy that's got a fourplex with four tenants with one meter, and they're not paying their bills, or he's got to pay the bills, and the bills are escalating because of their water usage. So then he would request through development services, and then we would go out and install the piping and whatever to do individual meters for that source, that plex. That's where we usually see where we would see multiple water meters on one property. It's usually a request, or if they go the other way, we'll go out and pull the meters, and then they'd have to hire a plumber to come in and figure out how they're going to get the water to the buildings.
Okay, so on the consolidation where they're taking up more space and don't need as many meters as the past use of the property, then this re-metering doesn't provide necessarily an opportunity. It's the same scenario where you have the infrastructure part of going to...
They just need to repipe it.
Reporting to the same meter, I just thought... no, if you're going to replace a meter, it might be a good time, and you want to get rid of meters, it might be an opportunity to nix that. I know the property owner would have some costs in consolidating that, but I don't know if there's any coordinated effort with it being more efficient.
Yeah, we coordinate with any time that we're going to change out a meter, we notify the resident, because we have we have got a meter replacement program, and every meter has its own identifying number, and then that gets accredited to the account. So... We won't leave one meter and put another meter in and leave that one there. So we'll take that because that's our property.
Right.
So that's how we can maintain that account. We'll be doing the same thing here, just in a larger volume. Every meter is going to, now that you're going to have a smart device on it, we not only have to make sure that we have the correct meter number for that device, mm-hmm. then we've got that device has got a component as well that's got a specific number to that meter, and then it goes to that account.
Jake, you're replacing meters...
Every day.
I don't know, how many a year do you think you do just today?
We're averaging probably about 15,000 a year.
So those, and the ones you're putting in already adaptable already to this technology. So regardless, they're already in the mode of changing out meters just to keep up.
Back in 2009, we went part of a reorganization of the utilities department. So I started overseeing the meter shop, and we recognized that we had a bunch of meters that were greater than 30 years old. So we put a program together. We brought in some temporary help through a temporary agency. We brought in about 20 employees, and all they did was change meters. And in 18 months, we changed 15,000 meters.
I remember that. So, yeah.
That's kind of what this project is going to be similar to. And so, but we do that every year. That's why you'll see, even though, because we've got 148,000 meters of just water meters out there, but we change meters on a regular basis, and we go for those older meters. Now, today, we can't tell exactly when they're going to fail, but with this new technology is you'll be able to see whether someone's tampering on a meter, mm-hmm. whether it's slowing down, or whatever the reason is, something's changing, we can send somebody out. Right now, we're only out there one time a month. Now we're going to be able to see this data right away, and we can react, yeah. especially with the diversions. Because even with these mechanical meters that we have today, there's always going to be somebody to do something. We have people that they know exactly when that meter is going to be read. So when after we're there, we read the meter, they take the meter apart, and they put a little device in between so that they get free water, and then they come back when they know that we're going to be back there again, then they put the meter back in.
Wow.
So we can't see that. But with this technology, somebody clips a wire or does something, we're going to know that right away. Mm-hmm. So whether it's diversion, whether it's a meter that's failing, or whether somebody stole a meter, we'll be able to get that right in real time. And another point is we have a transit community where we have our snowbirds that go for the summer and come back in the wintertime. I can tell you the number of times that we get calls from residents that when they come back, they say, hey, I had a caretaker on my property, and he said he wasn't using any water, but I've got a $100 water bill. We can't do anything about that. So sometimes those caretakers, what they do in one community, they have the caretaker. He goes out, he lifts the meter box lid, and he sets it on the curb, because that's going to tell him, to remind him that, hey, I've got the water on. I'm going to have to turn it off. Well, guess what happens when we're reading meters in that neighborhood that day? Our guys are going back and putting the lids back on. Mm. That guy forgets.
Thank you.
Now his water bill is really high and he's upset. But with this new technology, we'll be able to tell him on his first question, his first time he calls us, we'll be able to tell him exactly what happened on his property. On this day, you had a huge spike. We can't do that today. So,
I'm very excited about the technology. So I can't wait. You know, just for as you are, as far as being a director of the water, but just as far as a resident and talking with other residents about how the usage of our water, it notifies us, like, if we have overusage, you know, maybe have a break in an irrigation line and we didn't even realize it till we get the bill. Or in some of our challenged neighborhoods is the use of electricity. If we can find out when that is, we can maybe start focusing on what was going on in that particular time and what it could be attributed to. So I think there's a great benefit to our residents. So thank you.
This program is going to be a huge part of our conservation efforts.
Great. Yes, Jeremy, and then Kevin.
Just have a couple of comments and questions on the technology and security piece of this that you guys discussed. You know, you always hear about technology being implemented, or when you have like a rogue state hacking a nuclear power plant or something because it's connected to the internet, right? So are you guys looking at the security aspect of this to make sure that, you know, to Jake's point about people stealing resources, that people aren't actually hacking into these devices and manipulating them so that you know, their water is showing that they're not using as much water as they actually are? Is this like a perspective that you guys have looked at, and what are you doing to address that?
What's the bowling captain?
Put on. Bowling captain. Right after this. Mayor, Councilmember Whitaker. Yes, we're putting together an IoT plan that looks at security for all of the devices. So that's the Internet of Things. So it's all devices, meters, and I know you understand what IoT is, but we're putting together a comprehensive plan, and we're taking into account all the devices that are connecting into our network. We've got the network segmented in ways that we can separate it from our enterprise network and other precautions like that. And
just know when you get into this low voltage wireless technology, it's been my understanding is you could actually read an SRP meter today using technology that's available on the internet. Just the average person could drive by someone's house and see how much electricity they're using, right? So I guess my concern would be making sure that we're taking into consideration the privacy of the individuals, that we have to secure their, you know, whether it's their water usage, their electric usage, or their gas. You know, I think that's an important piece of it, to make sure that those devices aren't going to get hacked into. So I know you guys will take care of it, but I just wanted to make sure that was one of the things that we address. And then going back to the technology side, Jake, I know that they're with, you know, in the new world of big data analysis, and you talk about theft of resources again, you have the ability using like artificial intelligence to look for anomalies in data, right? So can you speak to if the consultant has said anything in regards to using big data analysis or AI or anything like that to look for anomalies that may exist within the usage of an average user, or theft of resources, just around those different topics?
Mayor and Councilmember Whitaker, that is one of the areas that we are going to be doing with Arcadis, with the consultant, is actually how to use the data. What's the best use of the data? Again, data management, how do we store it? What kind of analytics have other people done on it? What could we do on it? What would we need in our environment in order to achieve that type of thing? So that is a major area that we're going to be looking at, is the data management and data use.
Okay, great. The other questions that I had, are the customers paying for these meters, or is this a cost that we're just absorbing within our utilities as an operating expense? Or
Councilmember Whitaker, this is a capital project. And so when we look at this, we currently have a meter replacement program today that is just part of the capital improvement program. It's part of the CIP. And this would be part of that as well. So phase one with about the 2,000 meters and the software and integration and all that type of a thing, our current estimate on phase one is $5 million for that phase one portion of that. And that is currently funded through existing bond authorization of the three different entities.
Great. And what's the cost to roll out phase two?
Through the feasibility study, from the original feasibility study at that time, the estimate was $60 million. That's total for a complete service area. So I don't want you to say citywide, because we do have meters down in Magma as well. And so right there, that's looking at a $60 million all-inclusive across, and that includes phase one.
And that includes phase one.
That includes phase one. And again, and the bulk of that cost is just the true replacement of the meters. It's the meter. So it would be taking our meter replacement program and accelerating it. So instead of doing the 15,000 each year as replacements, we would be pulling that down. The current estimate through the feasibility study, and we'll be updating that over the next year, but in the feasibility study, it was estimated that we could completely implement electric in 1 year, and that it would take us about 3 years to implement natural gas and water across the whole city.
Okay. And I know, like, with water and gas, I'm assuming you have to use some type of battery technology, right? Because they're not wired in. How long do we anticipate these batteries lasting? And how often are these batteries going to have to be replaced in these devices?
And again, that's going to be part of what we're going to be looking at. It's going to depend on the vendor, the technology, their equipment, and how many times we transmit the data. So how we use, that's going to be that pro and con about we can get data faster. So we could, let's say we take a read every 15 minutes on water. Do we want to transmit that back to the main every 15 minutes? Or is it okay to collect that data and send it every hour or every 2 hours? That's going to make a difference on the battery life of that unit. So we'll be looking at that with our vendors and getting Arcadis to help us look at that. Where is that the best fit on how we transmit and so forth, and then what the life of those batteries are.
Do we have a ballpark estimate, like a range of how long
we're currently right now with the devices that we're using on the meters, which holds 40 days worth of data? Now, granted, we have to go in and retrieve that data, whatever. So the battery life is specified when we purchase it about 20 years. But you got to remember where these batteries reside. They're in meter boxes, they're in the ground, they're in the dirt. You get a water, a wet environment, dry environment, and the heat and stuff. So we're actually looking at maybe 8 to 10 years tops. Depends on how much data you're pulling out of it, but how often we go in and retrieve that data and then start all over again. So, and usually we only do that when we get asked a question about, hey, my meter, you know, something went up, it spiked. And so we go back and we try to find where that might have happened.
Yeah, it's significant, though. I guess I just want to make sure it wasn't like a 6-month rollout where I had to send some.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's significant. And the good part about the natural gas and the water is that it is a component. So you're not changing out the whole meter when you change that out. Because remember, for the water and the natural gas, there's a meter, and then there's the smart meter component. And you'd only need to change the component part, not the actual meter.
Okay. And my other question is, I know that there's a lot of technology that exists on the market today that people are actually paying for, right? Like, people are actually paying to put monitors that allow them to monitor their electricity usage, and they're installing them in their SES boxes on the outside of their house. Have we considered a concept in which we allow residents to purchase additional features where they could say, like, you know, if you want to monitor electricity per appliance or something like that, is that like an upgrade you could add to your account versus just standardized reporting in order to recoup some of the cost, the capital expenditures for the project?
For this, Mayor and Councilmember Whitaker, for this particular project, our goal is to switch out the meters and to start collecting that data. However, on our roadmap, for a smart meter roadmap, if you will, those would be types of things that we'll be looking at. What are those additional issues that we could do, whether it's home systems or how do we tie in, those types of things. So that will actually be going onto our roadmap for evaluation, and we'll get the expertise from Arcadis to let us know what other municipalities are already doing or what the options are in the marketplace.
Okay, great.
Councilman Whitaker, there's no restriction right now on whether a customer decides to put a submetering device on a particular appliance. There's ways of having inductive pickups, if you will, that can you can collect that data and measure that energy consumption. As a user of different utilities where you have that data, I can see when my refrigerator turns on just by the timing of it, when my water heater turns on, when my air conditioner turns on, just by the nature of the load curve.
Right. Yeah, I guess my point was that inductive technology that you're referring to, that people install those SES boxes, people actually pay for those, right? I don't know if there's a monthly fee, but I know those devices are relatively expensive, $300 or something like that. So I guess, I wouldn't be surprised that if you guys were to send an email out to residents, maybe like a beta testing phase program to say, hey, do you want to see live what your gas usage looks like, your electric usage, or, you know, your water usage, opt into this program, maybe they pay $99, right? And you recoup some of the costs rather than, but I would be willing to bet that for a first phase rollout, you would have a significant amount of people who would opt in to sign up to that program and reduce that capital expenditure for the people that want the technology, right? So I guess my only point is just looking at it from a perspective of cost recovery of how we can actually
enhance functionality.
Sure. And so my last question is I have two more questions. What's the annual operating cost are we anticipating for this entire technology?
Mayor and Councilmember Whitaker, we would need to, I can go back and look at that for that. But again, our ROI is a 12 to 13 years that we would be recouping that. And so if you look at some of the savings that we would have in efficiencies of not rolling our trucks and our staff to go out, as well as knowing when leaks and unbilled water and so forth. So we think that would actually cover the cost of it going forward after we recoup our capital costs.
Great. If you could send me that financial forecast, that would be great. And then my last question is, how long do we anticipate this system lasting for before they have to be replaced? Like, do these meters, we anticipate them to last exactly as long as the meters we use today? What's the depreciation?
The current meters that we have a 15 to 20 year lifespan. But, you know, the mechanical meters, so they degrade over time. And so the value of this is we can start to see that degradation and accuracy and replacing them. So.
Okay, great. And my last thing was, if I could get a copy of the report. Did Arcadis provide us a report when they originally came in and consulted?
It was actually Utiliworks. It was a different consultant that did the feasibility study, and we do have that feasibility study available.
Would you be able to send that to me with the financial forecast?
Yes, that would be, I don't have a separate financial forecast. We're using the forecast from Utiliworks
it's inside
as part
that.
Of the feasibility.
Awesome. If you could send me the whole report, that'd be great.
No problem.
Thank you.
I just have a couple of questions on the ROI. Is that taking into account that the meter readers will no longer be reading meters? And because really what it boils down to is you have, you know, 10, 15 people that hit the field and are running through checking meters. Now they're not going to be doing that. You're going to have one person driving up and down a street, and it's going to be picking up data as probably as fast as they can drive.
Actually, Mayor and Councilmember Thompson, there won't be anybody going up and down the street. The meters will be going remotely.
So it's even more up to date than when I was in the utility world. So the ROI takes into account those meter readers that will, I'm guessing, are going to be retrained into some other field or doing something else.
Correct. And Mayor and Councilmember Thompson, the ROI takes into account not only the savings that we would have, but also while some positions may be going away because we won't need those particular positions, just the fact that you're adding a new technology, you're still going to need positions. They're just going to be a different type of position, more of a technical or technician type of a position, because we still have the meters. We still need to check on them if they are not functioning properly. We'd still have to go out and check those meters. It would just be based on the data we're seeing rather than having people just go out on routes every day.
Okay. And then my last issue is always going to be on the corrosion side. You know, Frank, from... because when you don't have the meter readers out looking at meters monthly, there's really no set of eyes looking for corrosion. How are we going to ensure going forward that we have corrosion control in place and that we're not, our meters aren't getting to the point to where they become a liability?
Yeah, we have a fairly good surveillance program as it is right now, even over and above what the meter readers do. So I think we're probably going to rely upon that surveillance program. We do the leak surveys. We do the corrosion protection reads according to the standards. So I think we'll be able to maintain the safety of the system, even though we may not have that monthly eyes on each of the meters.
A couple quick questions. The earlier the slides indicated that this was tied to our fiber network, and it looked like the fiber network was good, but it wasn't everywhere. Mm-hmm. So how are we, I mean, are we going to have a ubiquitous citywide fiber network by phase two that we can do this everywhere?
Well, Mayor, fiber is just one of the assets that we would use, and it would probably be used for the backhaul or for actually taking that collected data and bringing it back to the city. So really, the initial collection doesn't need to go to a fiber. It would probably go to a collector, like a large antenna, if you will, that would collect that data as long as that collector then can connect to the fiber, and then that pulls it in farther. based on the technology that we go with. Again, we'll be going through the full RFP request for proposals from the vendors. Each vendor is going to come with a different proposal. Part of that RFP process is for them to tell us what that communication network will look like over the entire city based on their technology and our assets. How would they leverage our assets to use their technology on it? And then they'll be proposing that back to us as their technology and meters, but also they're going to be proposing their communication, how we set up our communication network, and then we'll be reviewing that. That's one of the great things about having Arcadis on board. They have done that in the past. They know what to look for. They know if a vendor has submitted something that has some holes in it or may not have redundancy that we're looking for. So they're going to be able to help us evaluate those communication networks. So we don't necessarily need the fiber everywhere in the city. We need it in key locations that we can kind of tap into and then send it along a way. If you kind of think of that as information highways, we just need to get to the highway somehow. So as long as we have a collector that can collect the data from the neighborhood and then that collector can get to that information highway, then we can send it back to the main location.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So it's not necessary that we have it everywhere as long as we have it in key locations.
Good.
I got a question on that. Which of these things here, which ones are the actual antennas that collect the data from the meters? Which ones are the actual collector antennas for those devices?
Right now, Mayor and Councilmember Whitaker, these are not, they don't have anything to do with smart meters. These are just our ITS towers we're currently using for communications today.
Got it.
So our communications area, this is what assets. We already have. This is our assets that we have here. So we would have, when the vendor comes in, we would look at these and they would say whether they want to use one of ours. That's because it's in a good location and they want to just put their technology on our tower. Or do we need to actually put a new tower somewhere because of where we need to collect the data from the households? This
you
is really
have to add more assets.
Right.
But at least we're trying to show you where you feel like we've got a pretty good coverage, whether it's fiber, whether it's cell towers, ITS towers, city buildings.
Right.
But there
fire
may be
stations, do you put a collector on the top of a fire station? Because we've got fire stations spread throughout the city. So these are just the locations that, and when we do the RFP out to the vendors, we will be giving the vendors a detailed data set, if you will, of where our locations are, our assets, how they can be used or how they can't be used, what's currently there, do we have capacity? And then again, they're going to be looking at that, looking at their technology and saying, here's our proposal of how we would set up the communication network in your city.
When they bring that proposal to us, is that something that will be brought back to council before making that decision, or is that something you guys will just decide on internally?
That's going through the team, through the project team, and it would be part of the staff recommendation when we bring the vendor forward.
What date is that anticipated when we'll actually see the technology of how they're connecting back?
That would be April of 2021 that we would be coming to council for award of the contract.
Okay, great.
Great. Any other questions? All right, thank you. We'll look forward
thank
to
you.
Watching this roll out. Next item on our... I'm sorry?
To the Smart City team.
Thank you. And good luck with the bowling league, too. next item on our agenda is to hear a presentation and discuss on the realignment of the paratransit service area. Jody, welcome back. Looking forward to getting an update on this.
Good morning. It's been a long morning for you guys, so I'll try to keep this short and brief. So with me, I'm Jody Sorrell, the Transit Services Director, and with me I have Ed Jones. He's one of our paratransit, or he's our one of our transit coordinators in our transit group. So this is just taking a while. So back in February, we were here with a proposal to realign our paratransit service area from citywide to within the 3/4 mile of a bus route or a light rail station that the federal government requires as their minimum boundary. We moved forward with that and put it into effect on July 1 of this year. So just as a reminder, this is what we used to have serve paratransit. The whole blue area was citywide. This is our current paratransit service area. So the blue is where we have paratransit service. The green does not have paratransit service, but we have an alternate service that is available citywide called Ride Choice, which we'll talk about. After we left here in February, We did a pretty extensive individual outreach to the paratransit customers impacted. We sent letters to everybody. Chris was very kind enough during that meeting to offer me extra resources, so we took him up on that very quickly before he could change his mind, and we were fortunate to be able to hire a retired Valley Metro bus operations person who's very familiar with transit in Mesa, and it was very quick getting her up to speed on paratransit and where to go, how it operated, and that really worked to our benefit. Terry called 203 of our paratransit customers who were outside the service area. About a third of those were no longer, their phones were no longer operating, so we had about two-thirds of them that were actually living in the area and impacted. In addition, she called 256 ride choice individuals who currently used ride choice who were going to have to go get ADA certified in order to continue to use that service. So there was a lot of one-on-one individual conversations with people. And we learned a lot about our paratransit, about this demographic and who uses our paratransit service in Mesa. Several instances we did, Ed and Terry met one-on-one with parents of individuals who rode paratransit to help them figure out the best option using ride choice. We've done a lot of visits to places like dialysis centers, the senior centers, libraries to give information where a lot of our customers go. And Terry and Ed continue to do presentations in residential areas, Fountain of the Sun, libraries, different places to educate people on the transit system and specifically talk about paratransit and ride choice. So this slide will show you, last fiscal year we did 112,000 paratransit trips. This year in the budget, we budgeted 93,000, a little over 93, and we're trending so far with the change to provide just under 90,000 paratransit trips. Our ride choice trips are trending significantly higher, but when you look at the total accessible trips, these are the key numbers. The total accessible trips, accessible demand for accessible transit is always going to increase, which is there's always going to be a demand for this. But we're moving most of those trips to ride choice. As you can see, we're at a little over 40% of those trips are ride choice. And to kind of put this into perspective, right now a paratransit trip this year is costing us about $45 a trip. A ride choice trip is costing us almost $19 a trip. So while we're providing more trips, but they're on a much more cost-effective method to use. This is a graph to kind of showing you how the ridership is going, and we're getting closer. At one point, many years ago, we did provide our ride choice trips. We provided more per month than we did in paratransit, and so we're going back, kind of getting back into that 50-50 split, which is where we'd really like to see our trips. And one of the things that we've done is one of our residents who came in February to speak, she put out a proposal to Valley Metro to consider a different ride choice option. Ride choice right now, you can get up to 58 mile trips for $3. That was the option we put out there. And she wanted to change that to put it into a mileage cap, proposed doing that. So if you take 58 mile trips, that's 400 miles a month. Let the riders choose a mileage or a trip cap. We looked at it, and pretty much every city that participates in ride choice, except for two, are offering this option for our customers. We limited it because we didn't know what that ridership impact would be. So we want to get some good data. So we're focusing on the residents that lost paratransit and offering this option for them. And where this works out is we may have some riders that need to take a 10-mile trip. So now they can take a one-seat trip and they use their mileage as opposed to taking that trip for $3 for the first 8 miles and then spending $2 a mile after that to get to their destination, or even having to have to transfer. We have a couple, the transfers do cost us as a city more money, and it's more of an inconvenience for our riders. So this is an option that many people are opting into that are outside that area to give it a try. And we've gotten a lot of good feedback. We had one mother whose son works at the Olive Garden at Southern and Alma School, who was no longer going to have paratransit, and her son is using the mileage option. And she called to tell us he loves it and he doesn't want to go back to paratransit. We are listening to our customers. We're trying to implement what they want. This has not been an easy, an easy process, but I think being able to having those one-on-one conversations with people and really helping them understand has really made the transition as easy as possible for all of them. And Mesa is not the only one, I should have backed this up, that realigned. Scottsdale, also effective July 1, they are enforcing their three-quarter mile area rule. Maricopa County, unincorporated parts of Maricopa County on October 1st started. They implemented the federal minimum of three-quarter miles of a bus route or light rail. And last month, the town council in Gilbert gave their staff direction to start moving toward implementing the federal minimum requirement. So it is, the valley is getting more in line with what the rest of the country already offers in that state. So that's kind of the update for where we are and how we're progressing. If you have any questions, we're happy to.
Thank you. Francis?
Jody, are we, based on the trips, the different trips on Prayer Transit and Right Choice going up, or is it resulting in any cost savings, or is it just a null? Is it the same?
It's not going to have a cost savings. So the less trips in paratransit is helping offset some of the increased trip costs in Ride Choice. And at the end of the year, what we do with Valley Metro is we do an end of the year reconciliation to see where we are. If we owe them more money or if they owe us money. So right now we could end up owing a little bit more money than what we have budgeted. But it's still a better option than paying for the more expensive paratransit option.
Sure. And then as far as the increase of Ride Choice trips, I know there is issues with paratransit, drivers and complaints around that. Is Ride Choice also encountering any complaints more than the usual based on our increase in trips? Or what's the status of kind of the customer service types, because that's important. I think residents came in last time,
right?
They also had complaints on paratransit, but not knowing what this change means on Ride Choice for them to be safe and secured and not be dropped off, in a place that they can't, navigate to. Or so, have you heard anything on the customer service side on our increased Ride Choice?
Mayor, Councilman Heredia, there's an education process, and I think it's getting better when you're not used to taking a service like a Lyft or an Uber to understanding how that operates. A lot of the customers were very used to having a cab, and when a cab pulls up, it's got the big sticker on the side of the vehicle that tells you it's yellow cab. So there's some process in being able to identify the vehicle, but I think it's getting better over as people get used to knowing where they need to be and where they need to stand. Ironically, one of the biggest issues we have sometimes is people coming to MCP because depending on what they call it, it shows up at, they can take them to 20 East Main or they can take them to this building. So that's some work we have to work with in the software and how it goes in. But people are getting it. We actually even had a compliment from one of the customers called in because the Uber driver, it's strictly curb to curb service. The Uber driver took them up, helped them up to the door and helped them with their packages. So that was above and beyond what they really have to do. So we're still working through some kinks, but it's not as bad that we're hearing not as bad as what we thought. One of the things that we want to do that we learned through the outreach process is later this spring, we want to have some roundtable discussions, kind of not quite focus groups, but some informal discussions with our ride choice users to get some feedback from them on the service and areas that we may have to work with Valley Metro on improving and different elements like that.
One other thing, is it easy for folks, or what's the interface of if folks have an issue or complaint on ride choice to submit that complaint based on them using Uber or Lyft or those means? Is it easy for folks to submit a complaint, or how is that tracked with the system? Because paratransit, you know, it's more of a streamline, but
ride choice is the same way.
Same thing.
Same way. Yeah, you can go to the Valley Metro customer service number and call, or put it in through the internet to give them your complaint.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Luna.
Hey, Jody, are you seeing more of an uptick on users using ride choice on the east side of Mesa, particularly in my community?
Yes.
Okay.
We are. I mean, because the east side of Mesa and parts of the northeast corner, they're now outside the service area. So that's where that's their service option, their accessible transit option if they want. So we are working. We have seen an increase. We haven't specifically plotted yet because it's still so new and the data runs about a month late where the riders are coming from, but that will be something that we'll look at after we've been doing this about a year to really plot like where the right people using ride choice are coming from.
Are you working at all with a multi-generation center and providing education that these are available to them?
Yes. Ed and Terry were just out there at the senior center and had a table 2 weeks ago.
Actually, it was a presentation, and Mayor and Council members, we'll be making ourselves available for public outreach probably from here on out. Now that all the light rail projects are done, we're able to focus more on our fixed route and paratransit being top of the heap right now. Mm-hmm. So we will be continuing to do outreach to different communities. We've been to the activity centers. We've got some scheduled events at the libraries next week and the week after, and we'll continue this process, not just for paratransit, but transit as a whole, because a lot of this community can use regular transit, mm-hmm. but they're not aware of what opportunities are available to them to do so.
Mm-hmm. And I haven't had a lot of complaints, so from residents on the east side of town. So it looks like things are working.
Right. We've had a couple come into Councilmember Thompson had a concern raised earlier this week. One of a resident in District 2 had some trouble earlier in the transition, and we've worked with Valley Metro and those residents to kind of help alleviate some of those issues and concerns. So, and that has been a real benefit to having Terry on staff to help this, Terry and Ed, because the people, sometimes Valley Metro has a very limited staff and they cover all the different cities in the valley. So sometimes when you're dealing with this change, you want to talk to somebody right away.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to reach us right away, and we can kind of be that intermediary, that ombudsman, to kind of set the stage for them to get things resolved.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions or concerns? I just want to say thank you. I know that we all knew this was going to be a very customer service oriented exercise. Change is difficult, and there's been a lot of literal and non-literal hand-holding going on through this process. So thank you for the compassionate way that you're dealing with this population and helping them to make the transition. Okay, thank you very much. Next item on our agenda, item 2, is to hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Council, what have we been up to? Yes, Mr. Luna.
Just really quick, yesterday I attended a community, the New Hope Community Center. I don't know if you've been there. That's where a number of homeless individuals live. They offer a number of services for homeless individuals in the east side of the town. And we also had an opportunity to drive with, Sergeant Kelly, who took me around District 5 and visited a number of sites, as well as visiting Las Palmas, which is one of my communities, just check to make sure everything's going well there. But I said, yeah, you wanna feel good? Let's go visit a kindergarten class. So we went to Jefferson Elementary School and went in and took pictures of the kids, and the kids were so receptive to our officers. So I want to thank Genesee Montez, the principal of Jefferson Elementary School. There were some issues related to Jefferson Park and the officers from the Superstition Station have been wonderful working with their school staff on that. So that's what we did yesterday.
Very cool. Thanks. I spent the day yesterday in Long Beach at a U.S. Conference of Mayors event Get Global was the name of the conference, able to participate in a panel there on international trade I was there really to do a commercial for SkyBridge, but it was well received and the whole country is very impressed with that project and look forward to doing a lot more commercials for SkyBridge as we go forward. Also, I just wanted to say congratulations to everyone in our community who worked so hard on the school overrides in each of our four school districts. That was a great day. I'm very happy for our students and our school teachers and those who were impacted by that vote and thank the voters for supporting public education in our community. If there's nothing else, Mr. Brady, how's our schedule look? Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me, Jen. I apologize.
Yeah, bypassing. I'm going to always say something. Talking about the school override, getting those kids ready to get into school. Yesterday, I attended the Mesa Early Learning Network that is convened by the city and is a number of providers and funders and organic contact points for families to engage those parents. So it's a Mesa-based team approach to parent engagement and child-family readiness for preschool, connections to available services such as home visitation, quality infant child care, social health services, and Mesa K-Ready, and eventually to preschool. So it's getting our little ones ready to go to school, and so that they are right there with all the other students, and studies have shown that they will go on and succeed throughout their lives just because of that early education and readiness. And 90% of their brain development occurs before the age of 5, so it's a key time to engage with small children and make sure they have the opportunities that will set them on a path for success. Also, yesterday I did a video, as I know Councilmember Heredia has been, and others.
I'm next.
You're next for Mesa United Way Harvest of Hope. It's a drive for grocery boxes for Thanksgiving, and they have an item list on their website of what they would like to see in the boxes, and also a $25 gift card. And this will go to families in need and distributed through Plaza de Cristo, a couple others that I'm just drawing a blank right now, but get it to those families. And if you would like to contribute, they'll be at the Mesa Music Festival next week, the 14th through the 16th in downtown Mesa and various locations, so you can drop those boxes. And if you don't have a chance to go shopping and get that box together, they're accepting donations online as well as at their tables at the Mesa Music Festival. And then last night, Rail Mesa hosted ASU for a community design meeting, and it went really well. And I'm very excited about this building and how it interacts with our community. And it's designed not only for today's technologies, but those we anticipate for many, many years, that it'll be adaptable and a part of our community that'll serve us well. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else, Council? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Brady, what's our schedule look like?
All right, Mayor and Council. So there will be no study session Thursday, November 14th. That's been canceled. So the next study session council meeting will be November 18th. I do think we have a few items for that study session, so we'll have an early start for that. This Saturday, November 9th, we'll have the Eastmark Great Park Phase 3 grand opening. That's from 4 to 8 p.m. So that'll be is a free activity. Invite everybody out for that. And then just a reminder that this Monday, November 11th, is Veterans Day, and we'll be having our annual East Valley Veterans Parade here in downtown Mesa from 11 to 1. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. If there's nothing else, is there a motion to adjourn this meeting? Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Aye. We're adjourned.